This is the Downeast Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. Reduced hours are in the future for many post offices as the United States Postal Service faces a financial cliff of their own. This week, L.C. Morris explains the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act, which is being blamed in part for the cutbacks.
Some would say the reason for budget cuts within the United States Postal Service is lack of items needed to be delivered. Fewer deliveries equals job losses thanks to the Internet. While the Internet plays a big role in today's society, it is not the true mechanism that's dwindling the United States Postal Service's budget. A congressional mandate is taking a big chunk out of the United States Postal Service's budget. At the end of 2006, it was mandated that the United States Postal Service pre-fund future retirees' health benefits 75 years into the future, and to do so within 10 years. It's called H.R. 6407, the Postal Accountability and Enhancement Act.
Kind of funding, no other federal agency or public agency, in fact, no other private company does it at that rate.
Judy Willoughby is the national business agent with the National Association of Letter Carriers. This postal reform law comes at a cost of $5.5 billion per year.
When we went into the recession, obviously we were making the payments with really no problems until the economy kind of tanked nationwide in all industries, pretty much. And so it's become a burden that the Postal Service can't stay with at this time. And even as the economy starts to come back, we're still having to pre-fund these funds because we're still in that first 10 years.
To date, the retirement fund is overfunded by $11 billion.
We currently have about $42 billion in the fund, which is plenty for people that aren't even employed yet. Much less retired.
According to the United States Postal Service's press release, the loss included expenses of $11.1 billion related to two payments to pre-fund health benefits.
I do want everybody to understand that we do pay the current retirees' health benefits with no problem. This pre-funding, this $5.5 billion a year approximately, is an addition to the current retirees that we already pay.
While other federal agencies are not required to pre-fund benefits, this decision accounts for $20 billion in losses over the past 4 years. As of the end of the 2012 fiscal year, the net record loss was $15.9 billion compared to $5.1 billion for the same time period the year before.
1980 or 82, we haven't taken taxpayers' money. There might be a little slim portion that goes for overseas balloting, but we strictly run off postage and products that the Postal Service sells. And so it's not a taxpayer's bailout.
The Postal Service is urging Congress for legislative reform to do away with the mandate that requires only the Postal Service to pre-fund retirement benefits. Until then, plans to shrink the workforce continue. Up to 150,000 workers will be affected through 2015. The price of stamps will increase 1 cent in January, and processing facilities will be consolidated. Monica Robbs is a communications specialist with the United States Postal Service.
Everything is on the table. So at this time, what we have announced is that Kinston, we would begin to move processing out of the Kinston facility and begin the process of shutting down mail processing in that facility in February of 2013.
No other processing facilities in eastern North Carolina are scheduled for consolidation in 2013 at this time. As to how it will affect service standards, Robbs explains.
On July 1st, we had an initial change in service standards. The initial change in service standards now means that the mail processed in Kinston, for example, that's received in Kinston and going out to the Kinston area is the only mail that's committed to be overnight.
Right now, the Postal Service is moving forward with the Post Plan, a strategy to preserve America's rural post offices. If the local office hasn't or will be closed, residents will see postmaster positions eliminated and a reduction in hours of operation for approximately 40 offices in the eastern half of the state.
Communities that are potentially impacted will receive surveys. They'll receive surveys that will ask them what their preferences are, give them several choices for how we'll go about rolling out the changes to them. There may be some communities that say, well, there's a post office in the next community over. It's only 4 miles away, and if that one's going to be open all the time, we'd rather just have that one so you can close our office. They may say, okay, we'll go to 4 hours, but can we have those 4 hours in the morning, or can we have those 4 hours in the afternoon because that's when it best suits our community? So they'll have an opportunity to provide some feedback in writing via the survey, and then we'll follow up with the community meeting.
Early retirement may be offered among other incentives.
We can have part-time employees who can work at maybe two offices. If there are two neighboring communities that have, for example, 4 hours of operation each day, then we can have one employee handle both of those offices, or we can have one employee do a two-hour office and then a four-hour office.
Community meetings have been scheduled through 2014, when the plan will fully be implemented. Smaller mail volumes or declines in first-class and standard mail can be blamed on the increased use of technology and competition.
In addition to that, the economic crisis that affected all of the country also affected the Postal Service. When we go with Wells Fargo and Wachovia, for example, which used to do two sets of mailings to all their customers, when they merge, we lost half of that mail volume because now they're one company.
Robbs goes on to say that just because pieces of mail per person has been reduced, it doesn't mean fuel is not being consumed.
For the Postal Services, we're going to those same addresses, and in most cases, more addresses in communities, but we're getting less. We're making less money as we go to those mailboxes because the carrier's routes don't change each day based on the mail volume. They still have to go by all the mailboxes, you know, regardless of how much mail they have.
And for those concerned about mail delivery less than 6 days a week,
we do have several actions pending at Congress that would give us greater flexibility. One of those would be flexibility in our delivery schedule. We are required by law to provide mail service 6 days a week. We also don't have flexibility with regard to what we can offer for sale in our post offices.
This year, the Postal Service reached its debt ceiling of $15 billion for the first time, according to Chief Financial Officer Joseph Corbett. In a press release in November, he stated, despite reaching the debt limit, the Postal Service mail operations and delivery continue as usual, and employees and suppliers continue to be paid on time. Resolving the pre-funding requirement is among legislative changes. The United States Postal Service requires to fully implement its business plan to return to financial stability. I'm L.C. Morris.
You're a mean one, Mr. Grinch.
The Pamlico County Sheriff's Department is on the lookout for a Grinch. Someone is vandalizing underground water pipes, causing thousands of dollars in damages, water outages, and low pressure levels. So far, there have been 8 incidents that have occurred in different areas of the county. All of them seem to be happening at night. This week, I spoke with Lieutenant William Jewell with the Pamlico County Sheriff's Department. He's asking everyone to be on the lookout for suspicious activity near water pipes.
Do you think it's just one person or maybe a group of people?
That is very hard for anybody to say. It may be one, it may be two or three doing it together, it may be one doing it by itself, and then another copycat.
Right now there is a criminal investigation underway to find out who's doing this. What kinds of leads are you working with?
We're just working on the information we have right now with the pipes. Appears to be an unknown individual. We've not got any reports as to who might have done it, any leads as to anything that's occurring. We've had several calls about people in the area places, but most of those have been checked out and nothing to them. And some of it, you know, it takes an individual with the intent to drive this pipe down, that piece of steel into that pipe. They're there for a very short period of time. All they have to do is step out, push it down in the ground until they touch the pipe, hit it with a hammer, and be gone.
Now, to do that, it kind of makes sense that someone that you've got to be looking for someone with some kind of knowledge on where the pipes are.
No, not necessarily, because all these are occurring near fire hydrants. They're occurring near water valves and things like that. All you have to do is look down there and see where it's at. And individual with any knowledge whatsoever, understand they run, if you've been riding around, so they run pipes beside the road. And if there's a main pipe and there's a fire hydrant sitting beside the road, there's got to be a pipe running from that fire hydrant to the main pipe. So all they have to do is push something in the ground until they touch the pipe, and boom. Now, could it be somebody with knowledge? Definitely it could be. But it doesn't take a lot of knowledge to figure out where a pipe's at in the water line.
As you mentioned before, you know, this is 8 different times that someone has punched a hole in the pipe. What are some other things that lead you to believe that this is, in fact, vandalism?
Just the way the pipe's punched. These pipes are not pipes. You can go along there and just, they're going to break on you. If they break, they usually split and crack. These are round circular holes. The inside of it is cratered out as an impact to the pipe. You know, it's not happening naturally. It's somebody intentionally hitting that pipe with that piece of steel.
Underground pipes seem like an odd thing to vandalize. What do you think is this person's motive?
Well, it could be plenty of motives. It could be somebody that's angry with the county. It could be somebody that dislikes the water system. It could be somebody who feels like they want to cost the county some money. There is no one set individual you can look at. You just have to take a look at everybody involved, from county, everybody involved in the water system, all the way out to people who might be mad at us.
What kinds of repairs have to be done to the pipes, and how much is it costing Pamlico County to do these?
What they'll do is locate the leak, go in. Now, some cases you would go in and try and put the flange on, you just put a repair sleeve over top of it. But most of these we've been doing, they've been cutting the pipe out and then putting a new section of pipe into it. It's going to cost you anywhere from $3,000 up to as much as, $8,000 licks, just according to where it's at, and how much time it takes to get to it, how much time it takes to repair it.
What kind of penalties are these vandals facing if they're caught?
Oh, they'll be charged with damage to property. According to the amounts on it, probably all be misdemeanors unless we tag something else to it. But, I mean, they're going to end up paying a lot of money out for all this damage they're doing.
And what is being done to make sure that, whoever's functioning these water lines doesn't strike again, doesn't hit any more places?
Well, the only thing we can do is notify the public for them to be on the lookout, have our patrol units out and about looking to see if they can find him beside the road. Like I said, it takes very few minutes to pull up on the side of the road, stick a piece of steel on the ground, find that pipe, hit it with a hammer, and you're gone.
Lastly, you know, we have listeners all over eastern North Carolina, including Pamlico County, that might have seen something or heard about something. Who should they get in contact with if they have information about this vandal?
They will call the Pamlico County Sheriff's Department at 252-745-3101. With any information they have, it'll be passed along to me as Investigator Jewel. They also, if they see somebody down in that area probing around in the ground, call 911 immediately.
All right. Well, Lieutenant Jewel, thank you for your time.
Bye, bud.
The Downeast Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with your local Edward Jones Financial Advisors, Dan Roberts and Michael Bass in New Bern, and Alice Cundiff in Swansboro. Branch location information available at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, making sense of investing.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. Usually I talk about the garden right in my own backyard. But today I'm going to talk about a garden of sorts that's just down the road from me. You might not know it, but here in Carteret County, running between the Corsound Waterfowl Museum and Heritage Center and the Cape Lookout National Seashore Park Building, is a beautiful set of trails. The trails wind through woods that are filled with wonderful native plants. I know we often think about parks and trails in the summertime, but I like this trail the best right now in the winter. First of all, there are wonderful mushrooms springing up all around in the damp woods. The ferns have turned brown and curled, and you can see some of the other small plants at the ground. Most of all, there are no deer flies or mosquitoes this time of year, so you can really enjoy your hike. One of my most beautiful hikes here has been when we had a snowfall. Next snowfall, if you can, come walk these trails. In addition to the wonderful native plants, I'm walking by a red bay right now. You will see pines and hollies and other plants from the Maritime Forest area. Part of the trail goes right by Eastmouth Bay and Back Sound, with benches where you can sit and look out over the water. You can see Core Banks from there. There's even a dock that you can walk across and sit down and look through what this time of year is crystal clear water to see what's going on below. I'm walking by the pond right now, and although the mallards that are paddling around in one corner have paid me no mind, I did scare up a huge blue heron. They make quite the screeching, squawking noise as they fly away and look prehistoric. The American holly trees that you'll find here are native. And check out the bark of the trunk. You'll see mottled colors, patches, greens, tans, yellows, some even red. Those are lichens, and they really like the bark of that particular tree. It's one way to help you identify that tree in the woods. Maritime forests like this once lined most of the eastern seaboard, but because the area was highly prized for development, many have disappeared. This forest itself has had strong human impact, but now it's preserved, and it's beautiful. I'm walking along the edge of the sound now, looking all the way across at Core Banks. So this might be a wonderful spot to bring some of your company that come for the holidays. There's nothing earth-shattering here in this little trail. Just a little quiet peacefulness, some beautiful native plants, a view at some damage maybe caused by hurricanes of past years. Something that makes you remember why we live here on the coast, with the water and the plants and the beauty. So this winter, while your garden is resting, come down to Harker's Island all the way to the end and walk the trail that runs between Cape Lookout National Seashore and the Core Sound Waterfowl Museum. And I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. We continue our Just Desserts series this week. Food writer and restaurant critic Eddie Browning shares his Inner Banks sugar cookie recipe with us.
It's an old recipe that you would have found, you know, in New Bern or Wilmington along the coast in the early 1800s, late 1700s. And I must give you fair warning on these cookies. They are dangerous.
What do you mean by that?
The dough is absolutely delicious. And one of the problems that we had when I was growing up was if I ever found out that these cookies were being made at the house, I'd hunt them down, my cousins and I, and brother, they'd all be gone before mother or grandmother had a chance to bake them.
Well, you'll definitely have to share the recipe with us now. What's the first step?
2 cups of all-purpose flour, 1/4 teaspoon fine sea salt, 1 teaspoon cream of tartar. In the bowl, sift together the flour, salt, baking soda, and cream of tartar, and then set that aside.
What's the purpose in sifting the mixture?
To increase the volume and make it easier to mix. In the bowl of the heavy-duty mixer fitted with the paddle, cream the butter and shortening on medium speed. Add the confectioner's sugar and beat on low speed.
So you're creaming together those ingredients, kind of looking for a light and fluffy texture. My guess is you would be adding your wet ingredients next.
Oh, yes. Add the egg and vanilla extract and continue beating on low until well combined.
Now, about the vanilla extract that you would use for this recipe. Been to the grocery store, seen the expensive bottle of vanilla extract, and there's also the cheaper bottle. Is there a difference between the two? I mean, are you going to taste the difference?
Lord have mercy. I made a lot of mistakes in cooking. At times, I have been caught and just would run out to the dime store and buy almond extract or vanilla flavoring. It was cheap, and believe me, it tasted cheap.
So we should spring for the high-quality stuff.
Oh, yes. You'll get a more intense flavor.
Back to the recipe. We've got all the ingredients in the bowl. What do we do next?
Beat until well combined. Cover with plastic wrap. Transfer to the refrigerator and chill until very firm.
You want to let that dough rest for a couple of hours in the refrigerator, but as you were saying before, that's the hard part.
That's the danger area. Your little children will find this dough, and it'll be gone before you can bake them. Keep them in the fridge for at least 2 hours. Preheat the oven to 350 degrees. Using an ice cream scoop or a melon baller, take some of the dough and shape it into small 1-inch balls. Place the dough balls on an ungreased baking sheet and press with the tines of a fork to flatten. Bake until pale golden but not brown, 10 to 12 minutes.
And after letting the cookies cool down, I guess they're ready to eat.
Oh, yes. I think you'll find these cookies to be some of the best tasting that you've ever had.
Now, decorating cookies are pretty popular during the holidays. Are these cookies that you would normally want to decorate, or?
Well, you could if you want, but I think those cookies are very delicate. I don't know that you would want anything else on them.
If you'd like the recipe for Eddie Browning's Inner Banks Butter Cookies recipe, you can visit our website, publicradioeast.org. And listen next week as we wrap up the Just Dessert series with an Inner Banks pecan pie recipe. You won't want to miss that. There's a long list of holiday programs airing on Public Radio East between now and the new year. Here to tell us more is music director Sefton Wiggs.
Thank you, Jared. Well, Sunday, December 16th, the Rose Ensemble's Christmas program, Slavic Wonders. They always do something interesting, does the Rose Ensemble. That'll be at 10 on Sunday, 10 in the morning. At 11 on Sunday, A Chanticleer Christmas, those wonderful singers. And from noon to 2 on Sunday, we'll have the St. Olaf Festival, a very popular program always with our listeners. And that program will be repeated later, and I'll tell you more about that in just a moment. Also on Monday at 7 p.m., Apollo's Fire, the wonderful Baroque group from Cleveland, will be performing the Vespers by Monteverdi. On Thursday the 20th at 7 p.m., I'll have Echoes of Christmas for you, and the Chanticleer Christmas will be repeated on Thursday the 20th. And on Friday the 21st, the first day of winter, Winter Solstice with Paul Winter, the longtime performer who always has a good time around the solstice. And on Sunday the 23rd at 10, we'll have Music of Baroque, some brass and choral holiday concert from WFMT. Leroy Anderson's music from noon to 1 on the 23rd, and Christmas with the Morehouse and Spelman Glee Clubs, a very popular piece always around Christmas time, will be at 1 o'clock on the 23rd. On the 24th, Christmas Eve, at 9 a.m., we'll have a Choral Christmas with Stile Antico, a wonderful group from England. They have several CDs out, and a great group they are, and this will be their first Christmas special for us. From 10 to noon, as always on Christmas Eve, we have the Festival of Nine Lessons and Carols. This is a live program. Each Christmas Eve, we have lots of folks that look forward to this, and we will have it 10 a.m. to noon. From noon to 1, Welcome Christmas, the St. Olaf Christmas Festival will be repeated from 1 to 3 on Christmas Eve. And at 3 o'clock, we will have All Songs Considered, which will be a little bit of a funny thing to have, at 3 o'clock on the 24th. And this program will be only on our News and Ideas Network. All these other programs are on our music programming on WTEB, but at 6 p.m. on the 24th, we will have Tinsel Tales. It's a program in which some of the NPR personalities tell about their Christmas memories, and that program will be on our News and Ideas Network. 7 p.m. on Monday, we'll have Apollo's Fire again, this time performing Handel's Messiah. We have to have Messiah in, and that'll be very popular, of course, again, and that's Christmas Eve at 7 p.m. And then on Tuesday, January 1st, as always, we'll have New Year's Day from Vienna, that live concert. And I also want to tell you about something that I'm doing on the 26th, the day after Christmas. A brand new CD from the Shandos label. It's all music of Sir Edward Elgar, The Starlight Express, which is a big work that Elgar wrote, and I'll tell you more about it when we play this. And this new recording features the Scottish Chamber Orchestra. Sir Andrew Davis conducts, and he also did some orchestrating of some of this music by Elgar. And it's, it includes a narrator named Simon Callow. He does a lot of this type of thing. He's an actor. And he does a lot of this type of thing with music. And that will all be coming up on the 26th at 1 p.m. The Starlight Express by Sir Edward Elgar. You don't want to miss that and bring the children around to listen to it. It'll be a lot of fun. And again, that is on the 26th, Wednesday at 1 p.m. And the program takes about an hour and a half. So be prepared to listen for that on the day after Christmas, Boxing Day.
To see the complete list of holiday programs, visit publicradioeast.org.